The Marion Finucane Show on RTE Radio 1 with Hyundai, Ireland's fastest growing car brand. Join the Hyundai revolution.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, caller, I tell you, there's a lot of confusion out there about Lent, I have to tell you. Marion, Lent traditionally not seen to finish until Easter Sunday, but in fact it ends on Holy Thursday night in line with the Last Supper. Happy Easter. Now, this person might know because she's a religious sister and she's the head of religious education in Loretto. So I'd be inclined to take what she has to say on the matter fairly seriously. Liturgical Lent ends on Maundy Thursday. Fasting Lent ends on Holy Saturday, anytime after midday. That's very confusing. The Marion Charlie Bird was brilliant describing life in the Arctic. Anyway, we'll come back to all these technical things. I remember my parents having a row about what was a collation and what wasn't a collation and could you have an egg or couldn't you have an egg and all those kind of things. But don't hear that much of it now. Anyway, let us move on. You know that some time ago we were talking on the programme about TED Talks, T-E-D, TED. And because there were so many great ones out there, we've decided that we will revisit them. And joining me now are Patrick Kinsella, who watches TED Talks daily, I'm told. Patrick's a freelance journalist, former head of DCU School of Communications. Rowan Manahan, a career advice guru who has organised TED events in Dublin in recent years. And Roddy Flynn, who's lecturer in DCU School of Communications, and actually he's here for something else altogether, but I gather you're interested in this as well.
Yeah,
okay. Now, first of all, you're all very, very welcome indeed. Rowan, you were with us before. Which one are Ben Zander, I gather,
is
one?
Oh, Ben Zander is just extraordinary.
Tell me more.
He's the conductor of the Boston Philharmonic Orchestra, and he's become almost as well known for his preambles to introducing a Mahler or a Beethoven piece and just the wonderful fluidity with which he speaks. And what he did at the TED conference was, with 1,600 people in the room, he got all of their eyes shining because he took them through the process of how one goes from being a beginner in learning any musical instrument, and in particular in portraying classical music and playing classical music, from the dunk, 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 dunk style to this just stunning, mellifluous piece. And why it's affecting us the way it is. So there's a little bit of science in it, there's a little bit of psychology in it, there's a little bit of sentimentality in it, and there's just this wonderful, wonderful voice telling us it all.
Okay,
enjoy.
Let's have a quick listen.
Amazing number of people think they're tone deaf. Actually, I hear a lot, my husband is tone deaf. Actually, you cannot be tone deaf. Nobody is tone deaf. If you were tone deaf, you couldn't change the gears on your car in a stick shift car. If your mother calls and says hello, you not only know who it is, you know what mood she's in. You have a fantastic ear. So I'm not going to go on until every single person in this room will come to love and understand classical music. Now, this is a beautiful prelude by Chopin. You know what I think probably happened in this room? When I started, you thought, how beautiful that sounds. I don't think we should go to the same place for our summer holidays next year. It's funny, isn't it? It's funny how those thoughts kind of waft into your head when we're listening to classical music. So let's see what's really going on here. We have a B. This is a B. The next note is a C. And the job of the C is to make the B sad. And it does, doesn't it? Composers know that. If they want sad music, they just play those two notes. But basically, it's just a B with four sads. Now it goes down to A. And now to G. And then to F. So we have B, A, G, F. And if we have B, A, G, F, what do we expect next? Ooh, the TED choir. And you notice nobody is tone deaf. So this is a piece which goes from away to home. And I have one last request before I play this piece all the way through. Would you think of somebody who you adore who's no longer there? A beloved grandmother, a lover, somebody in your life who you love with all your heart, but that person is no longer with you. Bring that person into your mind and you'll hear everything that Chopin had to say.
You were saying he's the only one that was allowed to go over the 18 minutes.
I haven't seen any of the other recorded talks go beyond that magic 18-minute rule. And I know that they edit some talks down, which have run a tiny bit long on the day for whatever reason. Sometimes the audience gets so bouncy and so interactive, or there's multiple applause breaks or laughter breaks and so forth. Yeah. A talk runs a tiny bit long against its intended. They have that cut off at 18. And our rule, for instance, I coach people getting ready for TEDx here in Dublin. Huge theatre, huge pressure on you when you're standing on that stage to deliver wonderfully, but also to stay within your, to adhere to your time limit and so forth. And the quiet reminder that we do at the beginning of all the rehearsal process for that is, if you go beyond 18 minutes, they will not put you up on the website.
Right.
And if you want your video to be seen out there, stick to your time. It's a marvellous discipline. His, I think, runs 21 minutes and it's worth every second of it.
And how do you go about finding, you know, which talk you want to view or whatever?
Well, there's several ways. You can get an email every day. They put a new one up on the web every Monday to Friday, sometimes two a day, but usually one a day. And you just look at the titles and think, oh, that one interests me, that one doesn't. Or you can go to the website and browse and look for the most popular, or look for the ones on the topics that you like. I think there's about 1,700 videos at the moment.
Yeah, and they're all tagged as well. Mm. They're done by category. So there's something like 150 categories of some of which are huge, like technology, which doesn't really tell you much.
Yeah.
But then there's cyborgs, which is only two on. So if you want to go there, you can go straight into it. And I think what's really nice actually about them is that they stress, you know, things like happiness as a category, and creativity as a category. It's not just about kind of finance and wealth.
And you can subsearch. You can say, I want to talk about architecture, but I only want funny talks. And you can drill down in that way. So whatever your discipline might be is a wonderful place as a jumping off point. Whatever your worldview might be, wonderful place as a jumping off point. And then, of course, the same as most clever websites, it then says, well, people who enjoy this talk also love this one.
Yeah.
Have a look. And the next thing you know,
it's
midnight and you're wondering where the evening went.
Yeah. Patrick, your first one is going to be Catherine Schulz. Tell me about it.
Catherine Schulz on Being Wrong. I'm not sure which clip you selected, but she's got a whole 17, 18 minutes on being wrong. And she asks, what does it feel like? And of course, makes the point that being wrong feels exactly the same as being right. But she also has...
Does it?
Until you realise you're wrong, but she it also, feels like you're
she
wrong.
She also has a part of the talk that I really love, where she talks about how do you respond to people who disagree with you and who are therefore clearly wrong. And she takes you through three levels. The first thing you think is, well, this person is ignorant. They don't know the facts. If they knew everything that I know, they would agree with me.
I think that's what we have. Okay?
The first thing we usually do when someone disagrees with us is we just assume they're ignorant. You know, they don't have access to the same information that we do, and when we generously share that information with them, they're going to see the light and come on over to our team. When that doesn't work, when it turns out those people have all the same facts that we do and they still disagree with us, then we move on to a second assumption, which is that they're idiots. They have all the right pieces of the puzzle and they are too moronic to put them together correctly. And when that doesn't work, when it turns out that people who disagree with us have all the same facts we do and are actually pretty smart, then we move on to a third assumption. They know the truth, and they are deliberately distorting it for their own malevolent purposes. So this is a catastrophe. This attachment to our own rightness keeps us from preventing mistakes when we absolutely need to, and causes us to treat each other terribly. But you know, to me, what's most baffling and most tragic about this is that it misses the whole point of being human. You know, it's like we want to imagine that our minds are just these perfectly translucent windows and we just kind of gaze out of them and describe the world as it unfolds. And we want everybody else to gaze out of the same window and see the exact same thing. That is not true, and if it were, life would be incredibly boring. The miracle of your mind isn't that you can see the world as it is. It's that you can see the world as it isn't. We can remember the past, and we can think about the future, and we can imagine what it's like to be some other person in some other place.
I never heard the word wrongologist before.
No, neither did I, but I think she made it up herself. I think the theme that she comes to towards the end of the talk is that, we should embrace ourselves being wrong, but also we have to be tolerant of people who are not actually, after all, evil, just different. And understanding that people disagree with you just because they have a different way of seeing the world is hugely enriching.
This is her thesis, or yours?
This is her thesis. I mean, right. I would add to her thesis that if people aren't evil, well, maybe they're just sick, and that's why they disagree with you.
Okay, that's one possibility. Now, your next one is Dan Pink.
Dan Pink talks about motivation, and I think you're going to play the candle problem, but maybe we should hear that first.
Okay.
This is called the candle problem. Some of you might have seen this before. It was created in 1945 by a psychologist named Carl Duncker. Carl Duncker created this experiment that's used in a whole variety of experiments in behavioral science. And here's how it works. Suppose I'm the experimenter. I bring you into a room. I give you a candle, some thumbtacks, and some matches. And I say to you, your job is to attach the candle to the wall so the wax doesn't drip onto the table. Now, what would you do? Many people begin trying to thumbtack the candle to the wall. Doesn't work. Some people, and I saw somebody kind of make the motion over here, some people have a great idea where they light the match, melt the side of the candle, try to adhere it to the wall. It's an awesome idea. Doesn't work. And eventually, after 5 or 10 minutes, most people figure out the solution, which you can see here. The key is to overcome what's called functional fixedness. You look at that box and you see it only as a receptacle for the tacks, but it can also have this other function as a platform for the candle. The candle problem.
Who is Dan Pink? Tell us about him.
He's a career and I suppose a management guru, you could say. The point that he's coming to is that in that experiment, the candle problem, they divided people into different groups, and some groups were offered an incentive. We'll pay you money if you can solve this problem faster. And what they found was that if they gave incentives, if they gave a cash incentive, people were slower. And this experiment...
You're kidding!
Absolutely. This kind of experiment has been repeated over and over again around the world in different forms. You give people games to play, and if you give them a money incentive, they do worse. The point is that money can change your behavior by the choices that you make. It can make you decide that you're going to work longer or work harder. But it can't make you more creative. It can't make you solve problems better, which is why, in the end, we shouldn't be paying any bonuses to bankers.
And what that points to is that idea of instrumental reasoning. You know, because instead of trying to solve the problem, you're trying to make money.
Yeah.
So your focus is making
clarity
money.
Clarity of judgment, absolutely.
Exactly, yeah, rather than focusing on the problem. And so hence it should take, if you think about it, it should take longer to try and solve the problem.
Well, that would debunk, as you say, the whole idea of incentives and bonuses in the workplace, wouldn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Dan Pink's point is that most of the work that we do in a modern economy is more creative than routine. Incentives work for routine work, but not for creative work. And therefore, he says, give people more autonomy in the workplace. Make sure they're well paid, but give them autonomy. And he quotes loads of examples on how in Google and various other places, they give their employees time for themselves to work on individual projects. And this is the time when engineers come up with the really good ideas, mm-hmm. where they're not being pushed to do a certain thing from above, but they're using their own autonomy to try and solve problems for the company and for society.
But I think that really encompasses one of the very interesting things around TED and other talking shops like this, which is it really is all about holding something up and saying, see that there? See the opinion you have of it right now? Yeah, think again. There's more to it than you first realised.
Right.
And we've done some interesting thinking, we've done some interesting reading, we've done some interesting research, and therefore here's the new thought that we have on the subject. And it's marvellous. I remember we had a speaker stand up last year talking about surfing. Now, what could be a more hobbyist talk? And I heard people outside saying, oh, I'm not going to bother going in for that one. Turns out this lady had been, she's a female surfer, a wonderful Donegal woman called Iski Britton. She had just returned from Iran. Now, I didn't know there was surfing in Iran, did you? I didn't even know there was a coastline in Iran when I started listening to that talk. And she had been, well, she had been down on the coastline teaching Iranian women how to surf, wearing the full headscarf and all the gear because one has to in Iran. And she was using surfing as a means of breaking down cultural barriers and as a means of establishing a small measure of independence and so forth. And she was spellbinding. It was just an extraordinary talk. Not harmed at all by the fact that her delivery sounded like a wave coming up and down on the shore with this lovely soft Donegal burr as she delivered it. It was extraordinary. And yeah, surf dudes, surf, 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 yeah, hanging 10, whatever. That would have been my opinion on surfing before I heard this talk. It absolutely transforms your worldview sometimes.
That's another theme of the TED Talks, I think, that to them, they're very optimistic. Mm. You know, the world is full of problems, but we can solve them if we think about them properly. Usually money isn't the solution, but new ways of doing things is. And another very common theme is that women ought to be in charge, or at least more in charge, and that the measure of society, I don't know if you have the Isabel Allende clip, but she makes the point that the poorest societies are the ones where women are treated the worst.
Mm.
Really? Have we got that by end of one? Okay, let's have a listen.
In our species, the alpha males define reality and force the rest of the pack to accept that reality and follow the rules. The rules change all the time, but they always benefit them. And in this case, the trickle-down effect, which does not work in economics, works perfectly. Abuse trickles down from the top of the ladder to the bottom. Women and children, especially the poor, are at the bottom. Even the most destitute of men have someone they can abuse, a woman or a child. I'm fed up with the power that a few exert over the many through gender, income, race, and class. I think that the time is ripe to make fundamental changes in our civilization. But for real change, we need feminine energy in the management of the world. We need a critical number of women in positions of power, and we need to nurture the feminine energy in men. I'm talking about men with young minds, of course. Old guys are hopeless. We have to wait for them to die off. Yes, I want to make this world good. Not better, but to make it good. Look around in this room, all this knowledge, energy, talent, and technology. Let's get off our fannies, roll up our sleeves, and get to work passionately in creating an almost perfect world. Thank you.
Yes. Wonderful.
She doesn't pull her punches no. either, does she, Isabel Allende?
Another take on the same thing comes from Hans Rosling. Hans Rosling has done about 9 TED Talks, and he's got, I don't think you have it, but there's one that's only 10 minutes long, and he's about the importance of the washing machine and how the washing machine...
Yeah, we actually do have that one, yeah. The washing machine, I suggested that one as well, Patrick. That's interesting.
Oh, well, we've got it.
We have one of those. You picked it, didn't you?
Rosling is the most extraordinary, and because he's... You would expect what he is saying to be utterly dispiriting and utterly boring because he's talking about death rates, he's talking about infant mortality, he's talking about the poverty gap across the world, he's talking about big global health and well-being statistics. And any time one ever sees any talk on this nature, it is inevitably boring. 2 factors. One, he finds the story to tell about the thing that he wants you to change your mind or to open your mind to. And secondly, he uses visuals, which unfortunately we can't be witness to here. In this instance, his visual was a washing machine in the middle of the stage, nothing more. And at the end of the talk, he started pulling literally the rabbit out of the hat out of the washing machine. It was presented at TED Women in 2010. It's wonderful.
Let's have a listen.
I was only 4 years old when I saw my mother load a washing machine for the very first time in her life. And the first day it was going to be used, even Grandma was invited to see the machine. Throughout her life, she had been heating water with firewood, and she had hand-washed laundry for 7 children. And now, my mother carefully loaded the laundry, and then when she closed the door, Grandma said, "No, no, 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 let me push the button." And Grandma pushed the button. Oh! Fantastic, I want to see this, give me a share. And she sat down in front of the machine and she watched the entire washing program. She was mesmerized. Today, in Sweden and other rich countries, people are using so many different machines. Look, when they want to travel, they use flying machines. And yet in the world, there are so many people who still heat the water on fire, and they cook their food on fire. Sometimes they don't even have enough food, and they live below the poverty line. There are 2 billion fellow human beings who live on less than $2 a day. I've done a scrutiny of market data. How do most of the women in the world wash? They wash like this, by hand. It's a hard, time-consuming labor which they have to do for hours every week. And they want the washing machine. But when I lecture to environmentally concerned students, they tell me, no, everybody in the world cannot have cars and washing machines. And then I ask my students, I've asked them over the last 2 years, I've asked, how many of you hand wash your jeans and your bed sheet? And no one raised their hand. Even the hardcore in the green movement use washing machine. My mother explained the magic with this machine the very, very first day. She said, now Hans, we have loaded the laundry. The machine will make the work. And now we can go to the library. I got the ABC. This is why I started my career as professor, when my mother had time to read for me. And we really loved this machine. And what we said, my mother and me, thank you, industrialization. Thank you, steel mill. Thank you, power station. And thank you, chemical processing industry that gave us time to read books. Thank you very much.
It freed up time for reading.
But what is great about it is that fact that I think in TED there is this assumption that we're always talking about iPads and kind of technology that tends to be associated with men. Whereas, you know, the technologies of domestic technologies like washing machines, these are technologies too, and in many respects are much more kind of politically radical than an iPad is ever going to be, simply because it can change, you know, gender balance.
Yeah. And he makes the point explicitly there that when you improve things for women, you improve things for everybody, because his mother had time to read to him.
That's a big theme in all his talks. Yeah.
Okay, well, listen, we will put the ones we've done now, we will put links to them on our website, but I have to take a break now.
1850 715 150.